Ready or not, here I come.
How long were you in the office?
I don't know, 10, 20 minutes? Mrs. White tried to call the police, but she couldn't. There was something wrong with the phone.
Diana faced the bench. Judge, at this time, the prosecution would like to move State's Exhibit 303 in full, and we ask that it be published to the jury. She watched the deputy wheel out a television monitor with a computer attached so that the CD-ROM could be inserted. Hide and shriek, the screen proclaimed. Choose your first weapon. A 3D animated boy wearing horn-rimmed glasses and a golf shirt crossed the screen and looked down over an array of crossbows, Uzis, AK-47s, and biological weapons. He reached for one, and then with his other hand, he loaded up on ammunition. There was a close-up of his face, freckles, braces, fever in his eyes. Then the screen went blue and started scrolling. Ready or not, it read. Here I come. Derek liked Mr. McAfee. He wasn't much to look at, but he had the hottest babe of a wife. Plus, he was probably the only other person in Sterling High who wasn't related to Peter and still felt sorry for him. Derek, the lawyer said, you've been friends with Peter since sixth grade, right?
Yes.
You've spent a lot of time with him, both in and outside school.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Peter getting picked on by other kids?
All the time, Derek said. They'd call us fags and homos. They'd give us wedgies. When we walked down the hall, they'd trip us or slam us into lockers. Things like that.
Did you ever talk to a teacher about this?
I used to, but that just made it worse. I got creamed for being a tattletale.
Did you and Peter ever talk about getting picked on?
Derek shook his head. No. It was kind of nice to have someone around who just got it, you know?
How often was this happening? Once a week?
He snorted. More like once a day.
Just you and Peter?
No, there are others.
Who did most of the bullying?
The jocks, Derek said. Matt Royston, Drew Gerard, John Eberhard.
Any girls participate in the bullying?
Yeah, the ones who looked at us like we were bugs on a windshield, Derek said. Courtney Ignacio, Emma Alexis, Josie Cormier, Maddie Shaw.
So what do you do when someone's slamming you into a locker? Mr. McAfee asked.
You can't fight back, because you're not as strong as they are, and you can't stop it, so you just kind of wait it out.
Would it be fair to say that this group you named, Matt and Drew and Courtney and Emma and the rest, went after one person more than any others?
Yes,
Derek said.
Peter.
Derek watched Peter's attorney sit back down next to him, and then the lady lawyer rose and started speaking again. Derek, you said you were bullied, too.
Yeah.
You never helped Peter put together a pipe bomb to blow up someone's car, did you?
No.
You never helped Peter hack into the phone lines and computers at Sterling High so that once the shooting started, no one could call for help, did you?
No,
Derek said. You never stole guns and hoarded them in your bedroom, did you?
No.
The prosecutor took a step closer. You never put together a plan, like Peter, to go through the school, systematically killing the people who had hurt you the most, did you, Derek? Derek turned to Peter so that he could look him square in the eye when he answered.
No,
he said.
But sometimes I wish I had.
From time to time, over the course of her career as a midwife, Lacey had run into a former patient at the grocery store or the bank or on a bike trail. They'd present their babies, now 3, 7, 15 years old.
Look at what a great job you did, they'd sometimes say,
as if bringing the child into the world had anything to do with who he became. She didn't know quite what to feel when confronted with Josie Cormier. They'd spent the day playing hangman, the irony of which, given her son's fate, wasn't lost on her. Lacey had known Josie as a newborn, but also as a little girl and as a playmate for Peter. Because of this, there had been a point where she had viscerally hated Josie in a way that even Peter never seemed to, for being cruel enough to leave her son behind. Josie may not have initiated the teasing that Peter suffered over his middle and high school years, but she didn't intervene either, and in Lacey's book, that had made her equally responsible. As it turned out, though, Josie Cormier had grown into a stunning young woman, one who was quiet and thoughtful and not at all like the vacuous, material girls who trolled the Mall of New Hampshire or encompassed the social elite of Sterling High. Girls Lacey had always likened to black widow spiders, looking for someone they could destroy. Lacey had been surprised when Josie had peppered her with polite questions about Peter. Was he nervous about the trial? Was it hard, being in jail? Did he get picked on there? "You should send him a letter," Lacey had suggested to her. "I'm sure he'd like to hear from you." But Josie had let her glance slide away, and that was when Lacey realized that Josie hadn't really been interested in Peter. She had only been trying to be kind to Lacey. When court recessed for the day, the witnesses were told they could go home, provided they didn't watch the news or read the papers or speak about the case. Lacey excused herself to go to the bathroom while she waited for Lewis, who'd be fighting the crush of reporters that would surely be packing the lobby outside the courtroom. She had just come out of the stall and was washing her hands when Alex Cormier stepped inside. The racket in the hallway rode in on her heels, then cut off abruptly as the door shut. Their eyes met in the long mirror over the bank of sinks. "Lacey," Alex murmured. Lacey straightened and reached for a paper towel to dry her hands. She didn't know what to say to Alex Cormier. She could barely even imagine that at one point she'd had anything to say to her. There was a spider plant in Lacey's midwifery office that had been dying by degrees, until the secretary moved a stack of books that had been blocking a window. She had forgotten to move the plant, though, and half the shoots started straining toward the light, growing in an unlikely sideways direction that seemed to defy gravity. Lacey and Alex were like that plant. Alex had moved off on a different course, and Lacey, well, she hadn't. She had withered up, wilted, gotten tangled in her own best intentions. "I'm sorry," Alex said. "I'm sorry you have to go through this." "I'm sorry, too," Lacey replied. Alex looked like she was going to speak again, but she didn't, and Lacey had run out of conversation. She started out of the bathroom to find Lewis, but Alex called her back.
"Lacey," she said. "I remember."
Lacey turned around to face her.
"He used to like the peanut butter on the top half of the bread and the marshmallow fluff on the bottom."
Alex smiled a little.
"And he had the longest eyelashes I'd ever seen on a little boy. He could find anything I'd dropped, an earring, a contact lens, a straight pin, before it got lost permanently."
She took a step toward Lacey.
"Something still exists as long as there's someone around to remember it, right?"
Lacey stared at Alex through her tears.
"Thank you," she whispered,
and left before she broke down completely in front of a woman, a stranger, really, who could do what Lacey couldn't, hold on to the past as if it was something to be treasured, instead of combing it for clues of failure.
"Josie," her mother said as they were driving home, "they read an email today in court, one that Peter had written to you."
Josie faced her, stricken. She should have realized this would come out at the trial. How had she been so stupid?
"I didn't know Courtney had sent it out. I didn't even see it until after everyone else had." It must have been embarrassing, Alex said. Well, yeah, the whole school knew he had a crush on me.
Her mother glanced at her.
I meant for Peter.
Josie thought about Lacey Houghton. 10 years had passed, but Josie had still been surprised by how thin Peter's mom had gotten, how her hair was nearly all gray. She wondered if grief could make time run faster, like a glitch in a clock. It was incredibly depressing, since Josie remembered Peter's mother as someone who never wore a wristwatch, someone who didn't care about the mess if the end result was worthy. When Josie was little and they played over at Peter's, Lacey would make cookies from whatever was left in her cabinet. Oatmeal and wheat germ and gummy bears and marshmallows, carob and cornstarch and puffed rice. She once dumped a load of sand in the basement during the winter so that they could make castles. She let them draw on the bread of their sandwiches with food coloring and milk so that even lunch was a masterpiece. Josie had liked being at Peter's house. It was what she'd always imagined a family felt like. Now she looked out the window.
You think this is all my fault, don't you?
No.
Is that what the lawyers said today? That the shooting happened because I didn't like Peter, the way he liked me?
No, the lawyers didn't say that at all. Mostly the defense talked about how Peter got teased, how he didn't have many friends. Her mother stopped at a red light and turned, her wrist resting slightly on the steering wheel.
Why did you stop hanging around with Peter anyway?
Being unpopular was a communicable disease. Josie could remember Peter in elementary school, fashioning the tin foil from his lunch sandwich into a beanie with antennae and wearing it around the playground to try to pick up radio transmissions from aliens. He hadn't realized that people were making fun of him. He never had. She had a sudden flash of him standing in the cafeteria, a statue, with his hands trying to cover his groin, his pants pooled around his ankles. She remembered Matt's comment afterward.
Objects in mirror are way smaller than they appear.
Maybe Peter had finally understood what people thought of him.
I didn't want to be treated like him, Josie said, answering her mother, when what she really meant was, I wasn't brave enough.
Going back to jail was like devolution. You had to relinquish the trappings of humanity, your shoes, your suit and tie, and bend over to be strip-searched, probed with a rubber glove by one of the guards. You were given another prison jumpsuit and flip-flops that were too wide for your feet, so that you looked just like everyone else again and couldn't pretend to yourself that you were better than them. Peter lay down on the bunk with his arm flung over his eyes. The inmate beside him, a guy awaiting trial for the rape of a 66-year-old woman, asked him how it had gone in court, but he didn't answer. That was the only freedom he had left, pretty much, and he wanted to keep the truth to himself, that when he'd been put in his cell, he'd actually felt relieved to be back, could he say it? Home. Here, no one was staring at him as if he were a growth on a petri dish. No one really looked at him at all. Here, no one talked about him as if he were an animal. Here, no one blamed him, because they were all in the same boat. Jail wasn't all that different from public school, really. The correctional officers were just like the teachers. Their job was to keep everyone in place, to feed them, and to make sure nobody got seriously hurt. Beyond that, you were left to your own devices. And, like school, jail was an artificial society with its own hierarchy and rules. If you did any work, it was pointless. Cleaning the toilets every morning or pushing a library cart around minimum security wasn't really that different from writing an essay on the definition of civitas or memorizing prime numbers. You weren't going to be using them daily in your real life. And, as with high school, the only way to get through jail was to stick it out and do your time. Not to mention, Peter wasn't popular in jail, either. He thought about the witnesses that Diana Levin had marched or dragged or wheeled to the stand today. Jordan had explained that it was all about sympathy, that the prosecution wanted to present all these ruined lives before they turned to the hardcore evidence, that he would soon have a chance to show how Peter's life had been ruined too. Peter hardly even cared about that. He'd been more amazed, after seeing those students again, at how little had changed. Peter stared up at the woven springs of the upper bunk, blinking fast. Then he rolled toward the wall and stuffed the corner of his pillowcase into his mouth so no one would be able to hear him cry. Even though John Eberhard couldn't call him a fag anymore, much less speak, even though Drew Gerard would never be the jock that he had been, even though Haley Weaver wasn't a knockout, they were still part of a group Peter could not, and would never, fit into. AM, the day of.
Peter? Peter?
He rolled over to see his father standing on the threshold of his bedroom.
Are you up?
Did it look like he was up? Peter grunted and rolled onto his back. He closed his eyes again for a moment and ran through his day. English, French, math, history, chem. One big, long, run-on sentence. One class bleeding into the next. He sat up, spearing his hands through his hair so that it stood on end. Downstairs he could hear his father putting away pots and pans from the dishwasher, like some techno symphony. He'd get his travel mug, pour some coffee, and leave Peter to his own devices. Peter's pajama bottoms dragged underneath his heels as he shuffled from the bed to his desk and sat down on the chair. He logged on to the internet because he wanted to see if anyone out there had given him more feedback on Hide and Shriek. If it was as good as he thought it was, he was going to enter it in some kind of amateur competition. There were kids like him all over the country, all over the world, who would easily pay $39.99 to play a video game where history was rewritten by the losers. Peter imagined how rich he could get off licensing fees. Maybe he could ditch college, like Bill Gates. Maybe one day people would be calling him, pretending that they used to be his friend. He squinted, and then reached for his glasses, which he kept next to the keyboard. But because it was freaking 6:30 in the morning, when no one should be expected to have much coordination, he dropped his eyeglass case right on the function keys. The screen logging him onto the net minimized, and instead, his recycle bin contents opened on the screen. I know you don't think of me, and you certainly would never picture us together. Peter felt his head start to swim. He punched a finger against the delete button, but nothing happened. Anyway, by myself, I'm nothing special, but with you, I think I could be. He tried to restart the computer, but it was frozen. He couldn't breathe. He couldn't move. He couldn't do anything but stare at his own stupidity, right there in black and white. His chest hurt, and he thought maybe he was having a heart attack, or maybe that was just what it felt like when the muscle turned to stone. With jerky movements, Peter leaned down for the cord of his power strip and instead smacked his head on the side of the desk. It brought tears to his eyes, or that's what he told himself. He pulled the plug so that the monitor went black. Then he sat back down and realized it hadn't made a difference. He could still see those words, as clear as day, written across the screen. He could feel the give of the keys under his fingers. Love, Peter. He could hear them all, laughing. Peter glanced at his computer again. His mother always said that if something bad happened, you could look at it as a failure, or you could look at it as a chance to head in another direction. Maybe this had been a sign. Peter's breathing was shallow as he emptied his school backpack of textbooks and three-ring binders, his calculator and pencils and crumpled tests he'd gotten back. Reaching beneath his mattress, he felt for the two pistols he'd been saving, just in case. To anyone who cares. When I was little, I used to pour salt on slugs. I liked watching them dissolve before my eyes. Cruelty is always sort of fun, until you realize that something's getting hurt. It would be one thing to be a loser if it meant no one paid attention to you, but in school, it means you're actively sought out. You're the slug, and they're holding all the salt. And they haven't developed a conscience. There's a word we learned in social studies, Schadenfreude. It's when you enjoy watching someone else suffer. The real question, though, is why? I think part of it is just self-preservation, and part of it is because a group always feels more like a group when it's banded together against an enemy. It doesn't matter if that enemy has never done anything to hurt you. You just have to pretend you hate someone even more than you hate yourself. You know why salt works on slugs? Because it dissolves in the water that's part of a slug's skin. So the water inside its body starts to flow out. The slug dehydrates. This works with snails, too, and with leeches, and with people like me. With any creature, really, too thin-skinned to stand up for itself. Five months after. For 4 hours on the witness stand, Patrick relived the worst day of his life. The signal that had come through on the radio as he was driving, the stream of students running out of the school as if it were hemorrhaging, the slip of his shoes in an oily pool of blood as he ran through the corridors, the ceiling falling down around him, the screams for help, the memories that imprinted on his mind but didn't register until later. A boy dying in the arms of his friend beneath the basketball hoop in the gym. The 16 kids who were found crammed into a custodial closet 3 hours after the arrest because they hadn't known that the threat was over. The licorice smell of the Sharpie markers used to write numbers on the foreheads of the wounded so that they could be identified later. That first night, when the only people left in the school were the crime techs, Patrick had walked through the classrooms and the hallways. He felt, sometimes, like the keeper of memories, the one who had to facilitate that invisible transition between the way it used to be and the way it would be from now on. He'd stepped over bloodstains to enter rooms where students had huddled with teachers, waiting to be rescued, their jackets still draped over chairs as if they were about to return at any moment. There were bullet holes chewed into the lockers, yet in the library, some student had both the time and inclination to arrange the media specialist's Gumby and Pokey figures into a compromising position. The fire sprinklers made a sea out of one corridor, but the walls were still plastered with bright posters advertising a spring dance. Diana Levin held up a video cassette, the state's exhibit number 522, "Can you identify this, detective?" "Yes, I took it from the main office of Sterling High. It showed footage from a camera posted in the cafeteria on March 6, 2007.
"Is there an accurate representation on that tape?"
"Yes."
"When was the last time you watched it?"
"The day before this trial started."
"Has it been altered in any way?"
"No."
Diana walked toward the judge. "I ask that this tape be published to the jury," she said, and the same television unit that had been wheeled out earlier in the trial was brought back by a deputy. The recording was grainy, but still intelligible. In the upper right-hand corner were the lunch ladies, slopping food onto plastic trays as students came through the line one by one, like drops through an intravenous tube. There were tables full of students. Patrick's eye gravitated toward a central one, where Josie was sitting with her boyfriend. He was eating her French fries. From the left-hand door, a boy entered. He was wearing a blue knapsack, and although you couldn't see his face, he had the same slight build and stoop to his shoulders that someone who knew Peter Houghton would recognize. He dipped beneath the range of the camera. A shot rang out as a girl slumped backward off one of the cafeteria chairs, a bloodstain flowering on her white shirt. Someone screamed, and then everyone was yelling, and there were more shots. Peter reappeared on camera, holding a gun. Students started stampeding, hiding underneath the tables. The soda machine, freckled with bullets, fizzed and sprayed all over the floor. Some students crumpled where they were shot. Others, who were wounded, tried to crawl away. One girl who'd fallen was trampled by the rest of the students and finally lay still. When the only people left in the cafeteria were either dead or wounded, Peter turned in a circle. He moved down an aisle, pausing here and there. He walked up to the table beside Josie's and put his gun down. He opened an untouched box of cereal, still on a cafeteria tray, poured the cereal into a plastic bowl, and added milk from a carton. He swallowed 5 spoonfuls before he stopped eating, took a new clip out of his backpack, loaded it into his gun, and left the cafeteria. Diana reached beneath the defense table and pulled out a small plastic bag and handed it to Patrick. "Do you recognize this, Detective Ducharme?" "The Rice Krispies box."
"Yes."
"Where did you find it?"
"In the cafeteria," he said, "sitting on the same table you just saw in the video."
Patrick let himself look at Alex, sitting in the gallery. Until now, he couldn't. He didn't think he'd be able to do his job well if he was worrying about how this information and level of detail were affecting her. Now, glancing at her, he could see how pale she'd gotten, how stiff she was in her chair. It took all of his self-control not to walk away from Diana, hop the bar, and kneel down beside her.
"It's all right," he wanted to say. "It's almost over."
"Detective," Diana said, "when you cornered the defendant in the locker room, what was he holding?"
"A handgun."
"Did you see any other weapons around him?"
"Yes, a second handgun, around 10 feet away."
Diana lifted up a picture that had been enlarged. "Do you recognize this?"
"It's the locker room where Peter Houghton was apprehended."
He pointed to a gun on the floor near the lockers, and then another a short distance away.
"This is the weapon he dropped, Gun A," Patrick said. "And this one, Gun B, is the other one that was on the floor."
About 10 feet past that, on the same linear path, was the body of Matt Royston. A wide pool of blood spread beneath his hip, and the top half of his head was missing. There were gasps from the jury, but Patrick wasn't paying attention. He was staring right at Alex, who wasn't looking at Matt's body, but at the spot beside it, a streak of blood from Josie's forehead, where she had been found. Life was a series of ifs, a very different outcome if you'd only played the lottery last night, if you had picked a different college, if you had invested in stocks instead of bonds, if you hadn't been taking your kindergartner to his first day of school the morning of 9/11. If just one teacher had stopped a kid, once, from tormenting Peter in the hall. If Peter had put the gun in his mouth instead of pointing it at someone else. If Josie had been standing in front of Matt, she might have been the one buried in the cemetery. If Patrick had been a second later, she still might have been shot. If he hadn't been the detective on this case, he wouldn't have met Alex. "Detective, did you collect these weapons?"
"Yes."
"Were they tested for fingerprints?"
"Yes, by the state crime lab." Did the lab find any fingerprints of value on Gun A?
Yes, one on the grip.
Where did they obtain the fingerprints of Peter Houghton?
From the station when we booked him.
He walked the jury through the mechanics of fingerprint testing, the comparison of 10 loci, the similarity in ridges and whorls, the computer program that verified the prints as a match.
Did the lab compare the fingerprint on Gun A to any other person's fingerprints?
Diana asked.
Yes, Matt Royston's. They were obtained from his body.
When the lab collected the print off the gun's grip and compared it to Matt Royston's fingerprints, were they able to determine whether or not there was a match?
There was no match.
And when the lab compared it to Peter Houghton's fingerprints, were they able to determine whether or not there was a match?
Yes, Patrick said. There was.
Diana nodded.
What about on Gun B? Any prints?
Just a partial one, on the trigger. Nothing of value.
What does that mean, exactly?
Patrick turned to the jury.
A print of value in fingerprint typing is one that can be compared to another known print and either excluded or included as a match to that print. People leave fingerprints on items they touch all the time, but not necessarily ones we can use. They might be smudged or too incomplete to be considered forensically valuable.
So, Detective, you don't know for a fact who left the fingerprint on Gun B?
No.
But it could have been Peter Houghton.
Yes.
Do you have any evidence that anyone else at Sterling High School was carrying a weapon that day?
No.
How many weapons were eventually found in the locker room?
4, Patrick said. 1 handgun with the defendant, 1 on the floor, and 2 sawed-off shotguns in a knapsack.
In addition to processing the weapons found in the locker room for fingerprints, did the lab do any other forensic testing on them?
Yes, a ballistics test.
Can you explain that?
Well, Patrick said, you shoot the gun into water, basically. Every bullet that comes out of a gun has markings on it that are put in place when a bullet twists its way through the barrel of the gun. That means you can type each bullet to a gun that has been fired by test firing a gun to see what a bullet would look like once fired from it, and then matching up bullets that have been retrieved. You can also tell whether a gun has ever been fired at all by examining residue within the barrel.
Did you test all 4 weapons?
Yes.
And what were the results of your tests?
Only 2 of the 4 guns were actually fired, Patrick said. The handguns, A and B. Of the bullets that we found, all were determined to have come from Gun A. Gun B, when we retrieved it, had been jammed with a double feed. That means 2 bullets had entered the chamber at the same time, which keeps the gun from properly functioning. When the trigger was pulled, it locked up.
But you said Gun B was fired.
At least once.
Patrick looked up at Diana.
The bullet has not been recovered to date.
Diana Levin led Patrick meticulously through the discovery of 10 dead students and 19 wounded ones. He started with the moment that he walked out of Sterling High with Josie Cormier in his arms and placed her in an ambulance, and ended with the last body being moved to the medical examiner's morgue. Then the judge adjourned court for the day. After he got off the stand, Patrick talked with Diana for a moment about what would happen tomorrow. The double doors of the courtroom were open, and through them, Patrick could see reporters sucking the stories out of any angry parent who was willing to give an interview. He recognized the mother of a girl, Jada Knight, who'd been shot in the back while she was running from the cafeteria.
My daughter won't go to school this year until 11 o'clock because she can't handle being there when third period starts, the woman said. Everything scares her. This has ruined her whole life. Why should Peter Houghton's punishment be any less?
He had no desire to run the media gauntlet, and as the only witness for the day, he was bound to be mobbed. So instead, Patrick sat down on the wooden railing that separated the court professionals from the gallery.
"Hey."
He turned at the sound of Alex's voice.
"What are you still doing here?"
He would have assumed she was upstairs, springing Josie out of the sequestered witness room, as she had done yesterday.
"I could ask you the same thing."
Patrick nodded toward the doorway.
"I wasn't in the mood to do battle."
Alex came closer until she was standing between his legs and wrapped her arms around him. She buried her face against his neck, and when she took a deep, rattling breath, Patrick felt it in his own chest.
"You could have fooled me," she said.
Jordan McAfee was not having a good day. The baby had spit up on him on his way out the door. He had been 10 minutes late for court because the goddamn media were multiplying like jackrabbits and there were no parking spots, and Judge Wagner had reprimanded him for his tardiness. Add to this the fact that for whatever reason, Peter had stopped communicating with Jordan, except for the odd grunt, and that his first order of the morning would be to cross-examine the knight in shining armor who had rushed into the school to confront the evil shooter. Well, being a defense attorney didn't get much more fabulous than this. "Detective," he said, approaching Patrick Ducharme on the witness stand. "After you finished with the medical examiner, you went back to the police department?"
"Yes."
"You were holding Peter there, weren't you?"
"Yes."
"In a jail cell, with bars and a lock on it?"
"It's a holding cell," Ducharme corrected.
"Had Peter been charged with any crime yet?"
"No."
"He wasn't actually charged with anything until the following morning, is that right?"
"That's correct."
"Where did he stay that night?"
"At the Grafton County Jail."
"Detective, did you speak to my client at all?" Jordan asked.
"Yes, I did."
"What did you ask him?"
The detective folded his arms. "If he wanted some coffee."
"Did he take you up on the offer?"
"Yes."
"Did you ask him at all about the incident at the school?"
"I asked him what had happened,"
Ducharme said. "How did Peter respond?"
The detective frowned. "He said he wanted his mother."
"Did he start crying?"
"Yes."
"In fact, he didn't stop crying, not the whole time you tried to question him. Isn't that true?"
"Yes, it is."
"Did you ask him any other questions, detective?"
"No."
Jordan stepped forward. "You didn't bother to, because my client was in no shape to be going through an interview."
"I didn't ask him any more questions," Ducharme said evenly. "I have no idea what kind of shape he was in."
"So you took a kid, a 17-year-old kid, who was crying for his mother, back to your holding cell?"
"Yes, but I told him I wanted to help him."
Jordan glanced at the jury and let that statement sink in for a moment. "What was Peter's response?"
"He looked at me," the detective answered, "and he said, 'They started it.'"
Curtis Uppergate had been a forensic psychiatrist for 25 years. He held degrees from 3 Ivy League medical schools and had a CV thick enough to serve as a doorstop. He was lily white, but wore his shoulder-length gray hair cornrowed and had come to court in a dashiki. Diana nearly expected him to call her Sista when she questioned him. "What's your field of expertise, doctor?"
"I work with violent teenagers. I assess them on behalf of the court to determine the nature of their mental illnesses, if any, and figure out an appropriate treatment plan. I also advise the court as to what their state of mind may have been at the time a crime has been committed. I worked with the FBI to create their profiles of school shooters and to examine parallels between cases at Thurston High, Paducah, Ricori, and Columbine."
"When did you first become involved in this case?"
"Last April." Did you review Peter Houghton's records?
Yes, Uppergate said. I reviewed all the records I received from you, Ms. Levin. Extensive school and medical records, police reports, interviews done by Detective Ducharme.
What in particular were you looking for?
Evidence of mental illness, he said. Physical explanations for the behavior, a psychosocial construct that might resemble those of other perpetrators of school violence.
Diana glanced at the jury. Their eyes were glazing over.
As a result of your work, did you reach any conclusion, with a reasonable degree of medical certainty, as to Peter Houghton's mental state on March 6, 2007?
Yes, Uppergate said, and he faced the jury, speaking slowly and clearly. Peter Houghton was not suffering from any mental illness at the time he started shooting at Sterling High School.
Can you tell us how you reached that conclusion?
The definition of sanity implies being in touch with the reality of what you're doing at the time you do it. There's evidence that Peter had been planning this attack for a while, from stockpiling ammunition and guns, to making lists of targeted victims, to rehearsing his Armageddon through a self-designed video game. The shooting wasn't a departure for Peter. It was something he had been considering all along, with great premeditation.
Are there other examples of Peter's premeditation?
When he first reached the school and saw a friend in the parking lot, he tried to warn him off, for safety. He lit a pipe bomb in a car before going into the school, to serve as a diversion so that he could enter unimpeded with his guns. He concealed weapons that were preloaded. He targeted areas in the school where he himself had been victimized. These are not the acts of someone who doesn't know what he's doing. They're the hallmarks of a rational, angry, perhaps suffering, but certainly not delusional, young man.
Diana paced in front of the witness stand.
Doctor, were you able to compare information from past school shootings to this one in order to support your conclusion that the defendant was sane and responsible for his actions?
Uppergate flipped his braids over his shoulder.
None of the shooters from Columbine, Paducah, Thurston, or Ricori had status. It's not that they're loners, but in their minds they perceive that they are not members of the group to the same degree as anyone else in that group. Peter was on the soccer team, for example, but was one of two students never put into play. He was bright, but his grades didn't reflect that. He had a romantic interest, but that interest went unreturned. The only venue where he did feel comfortable was in a world of his own creation, computer games, where Peter was not only comfortable, he was God.
Does that mean he was living in a fantasy world on March 6th?
Absolutely not. If he had been, he wouldn't have been planning his attack as rationally and methodically.
Diana turned. There's been some evidence, Doctor, that Peter was the subject of bullying in school. Have you reviewed that information?
Yes, I have.
Has your research told you anything about the effect of bullying on kids like Peter?
In every single school shooting case, Uppergate said, the bullying card gets played. It's the bullying, allegedly, that makes the school shooter snap one day and fight back with violence. However, in every other case, and this one, in my opinion, the bullying seems exaggerated by the shooter. The teasing isn't significantly worse for the shooter than it is for anyone else at the school.
Then why shoot?
It becomes a public way to take control of a situation in which they usually feel powerless, Curtis Uppergate said, which, again, means it's something they've been planning for a while.
Your witness, Diana said.
Jordan stood up and approached Dr. Uppergate. When did you first meet Peter?
Well, we haven't officially been introduced.
But you're a psychiatrist?
Last time I checked, Uppergate said. I thought the field of psychiatry was based on gaining a rapport with your client and getting to know what he thinks about the world and how he processes it.
That's part of it.
That's an incredibly important part of it, isn't it? Jordan asked.
Yes.
Would you write a prescription for Peter today?
No.
Because you'd have to physically meet with him before you decided whether he was an appropriate candidate for that medicine, correct?
Yes.
Doctor, did you get a chance to talk to the school shooters from Thurston High?
Yes, I did, Uppergate said.
What about the boy from Paducah?
Yes.
Ricori?
Yes.
Not Columbine.
I'm a psychiatrist, Mr. McAfee, Uppergate said. Not a medium. However, I did speak at length to the families of the two boys. I read their diaries and examined their videos.
Doctor, Jordan asked, did you ever once speak directly to Peter Houghton?
Curtis Uppergate hesitated.
No, he said. I did not.
Jordan sat down, and Diana faced the judge.
Your Honor, she said. The prosecution rests.
Here, Jordan said, tossing Peter half a sandwich as he entered the holding cell. Or are you on a hunger strike, too?
Peter glared at him, but unwrapped the sandwich and took a bite.
I don't like turkey.
I don't really care. He leaned against the cement wall of the holding cell.
You want to tell me who peed in your Cheerios today? Do you have any idea what it's like to sit in that room and listen to all these people talk about me like I'm not there? Like I can't even hear what they're saying about me?
That's the way the game's played, Jordan said. Now it's our turn.
Peter stood up and walked to the front of the cell.
Is that what this is to you? Some game?
Jordan closed his eyes, counting to 10 for patience.
Of course not. How much money do you get paid?
Peter asked.
That's not your how much?
Ask your parents, Jordan said flatly.
You get paid whether I win or lose, right?
Jordan hesitated and then nodded.
So you don't really give a shit what the outcome is, do you?
It struck Jordan, with some wonder, that Peter had the chops to be an excellent defense attorney. That sort of circular reasoning, the kind that left the person being grilled hung out to dry, was exactly what you aimed for in a courtroom.
What? Peter accused. Now you're laughing at me, too?
No, I was just thinking you'd be a good lawyer. Peter sank down again.
Great. Maybe the state prison offers that degree along with a GED.
Jordan reached for the sandwich in Peter's hand and took a bite.
Let's just wait and see how it goes, he said.
A jury was always impressed by King Wah's record, and Jordan knew it. He'd interviewed over 500 subjects. He'd been an expert witness at 248 trials, not including this one. He had written more papers than any other forensic psychiatrist with a specialty in post-traumatic stress disorder. And, here was the beautiful part, he'd taught 3 seminars that had been attended by the prosecution's witness, Dr. Curtis Uppergate.
Dr. Wah, Jordan began, when did you first begin to work on this case?
I was contacted by you, Mr. McAfee, in June. I agreed to meet with Peter at that time.
Did you?
Yes, for over 10 hours of interviews. I also sat down and read the police reports, the medical and school records of both Peter and his older brother. I met with his parents. I then sent him to be examined by my colleague, Dr. Lawrence Gertz, who is a pediatric neuropsychiatrist.
What does a pediatric neuropsychiatrist do?
Studies organic causes for mental symptomology and disorder in children.
What did Dr. Gertz do?
He took several MRI scans of Peter's brain, King said.
Dr. Gertz uses brain scans to show that there are structural changes in the adolescent brain that not only explain the timing of some major mental illnesses like schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, but also give biological reasons for some of the wild conduct that parents usually attribute to raging hormones. That's not to say that there aren't raging hormones in adolescence, but there's also a paucity of the cognitive controls that are necessary for mature behavior. Jordan turned to the jury.
Did you get that? Because I'm lost.
King grinned. Layman's terms? You can tell a lot about a kid by looking at his brain. There might actually be a physiological reason why, when you tell your 17-year-old to put the milk back in the fridge, he nods and then completely ignores you.
Did you send Peter to Dr. Gertz because you thought he was bipolar or schizophrenic?
No. But part of my responsibility involves ruling those causes out before I begin to look at other reasons for his behavior.
Did Dr. Gertz send you a report detailing his findings?
Yes.
Can you show us?
Jordan lifted up a diagram of a brain that he'd already entered as evidence and handed it to King. Dr. Gertz said that Peter's brain looked very similar to a typical adolescent brain in that the prefrontal cortex was not as developed as you'd find in a mature adult brain.
Whoa, Jordan said. You're losing me again.
The prefrontal cortex is right here, behind the forehead. It's sort of like the president of the brain, in charge of calculated, rational thought. It's also the last part of the brain to mature, which is why teenagers often get into so much trouble. Then he pointed to a tiny spot on the diagram, centrally located. This is called the amygdala. Since a teenager's decision-making center isn't completely turned on yet, they rely on this little piece of the brain instead. This is the impulsive epicenter of the brain, the one that houses feelings like fear and anger and gut instinct, or, in other words, the part of the brain that corresponds to, because my friends thought it was a good idea, too. Most of the jury chuckled, and Jordan caught Peter's eye. He wasn't slumped in the chair anymore. He was sitting up, listening carefully. It's fascinating, really, King said, because a 20-year-old might be physiologically capable of making an informed decision, but a 17-year-old won't be. Did Dr. Gertz perform any other psychological tests?
Yes, he did a second MRI, one that was performed while Peter was working on a simple task. Peter was given photographs of faces and asked to identify the emotions reflected on them. Unlike a test group of adults who got most of those assessments correct, Peter tended to make errors. In particular, he identified fearful expressions as angry, confused, or sad. The MRI scan showed that while he was focused on this task, it was the amygdala that was doing the work, not the prefrontal cortex.
What can you infer from that, Dr. Waugh?
Well, Peter's capacity for rational, planned, premeditated thought is still in its developmental stages. Physiologically, he just can't do it yet.
Jordan watched the juror's response to this statement.
Dr. Waugh, you said you met with Peter as well?
Yes, at the correctional facility for 10 one-hour sessions.
Where did you meet with him?
In a conference room. I explained who I was and that I was working with his attorney, King said.
Was Peter reluctant to speak to you?
No.
The psychiatrist paused.
He seemed to enjoy the company.
Did anything strike you about him at first?
He seemed unemotional, not crying or smiling or laughing or showing hostility. In the business, we call it flat affect.
What did you two talk about?
King looked at Peter and smiled.
The Red Sox, he said,
and his family.
What did he tell you?
That Boston deserved another pennant, which,
as a Yankees fan myself, was enough to call into question his capacity for rational thought.
Jordan grinned.
What did he say about his family?
He explained that he lived with his mother and father, and that his older brother, Joey, had been killed by a drunk driver about a year earlier. Joey had been a year older than Peter. We also talked about things he liked to do, mostly centered on programming and computers, and about his childhood.
What did he tell you about that? Jordan asked.
Most of Peter's childhood memories involve situations where he was victimized, either by other children or by adults whom he'd perceived as being able to help him, yet didn't. He described everything from physical threats, get out of my way or I'm going to punch your lights out, to physical actions, doing nothing more than walking down a hallway and being slammed up against the wall because he happened to get too close to someone walking past him, to emotional taunts, like being called homo or queer.
Did he tell you when this bullying started?
The first day of kindergarten. He got on the bus, was tripped as he walked down the aisle, and had his Superman lunchbox thrown onto the highway. It continued up to shortly before the shooting, when he suffered public humiliation after his romantic interest in a classmate was revealed.
Doctor, Jordan said. Didn't Peter ask for help?
Yes, but even when it was given, the result backfired. Once, for example, after being shoved by a boy at school, Peter charged him. This was seen by a teacher who brought both boys to the principal's office for detention. In Peter's mind, he had defended himself, and yet he was being punished as well.
King relaxed on the stand.
More recent memories were colored by Peter's brother's death and his inability to live up to the same standards his brother had set as a student and a son.
Did Peter talk about his parents?
Yes, Peter loved his parents, but didn't feel he could rely on them for protection.
Protection from what?
Troubles in school, feelings he was having, suicide ideation.
Jordan turned toward the jury. Based on your discussions with Peter and Dr. Gertz's findings, were you able to diagnose Peter's state of mind on March 6th, 2007, with a reasonable degree of medical certainty?
Yes. Peter was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Can you explain what that is?
King nodded. It's a psychiatric disorder that can occur following an experience in which a person is oppressed or victimized. For example, we've all heard of soldiers who come home from war and can't adjust to the world because of PTSD. People who suffer from PTSD often relive the experience through nightmares, have difficulty sleeping, feel detached. In extreme cases, after exposure to serious trauma, they might exhibit hallucinations or dissociation.
Are you saying that Peter was hallucinating on the morning of March 6th?
No. I believe that he was in a dissociative state.
What's that?
It's when you're physically present, but mentally removed, King explained. When you can separate your feelings about an event from the knowledge of it.
Jordan knit his brows together. Hang on, Doctor. Do you mean that a person in a dissociative state could drive a car?
Absolutely.
And set up a pipe bomb?
Yes.
And load weapons?
Yes.
And fire those weapons?
Sure.
And all that time, that person wouldn't know what he was doing?
Yes, Mr. McAfee, King said. That's exactly right.
In your opinion, when did Peter slip into this dissociative state?
During our interviews, Peter explained that the morning of March 6th, he got up early and went to check a website for feedback on his video game. By accident, he pulled up an old file on his computer, the email he had sent to Josie Cormier, detailing his feelings for her. It was the same email that, weeks before, had been sent to the entire school, and that had preceded an even greater humiliation when his pants were pulled down in the cafeteria.
After he saw that email, he said he can't really remember the rest of what happened.
I pull up old files by accident on my computer all the time, Jordan said, but I don't go into a dissociative state.
The computer had always been a safe haven for Peter,